Thank you very much, Chris. Hang on, David, one second. What we'll do is we'll actually merge the final Q&A here. I request Mohan, Nandan come up, and Shibu also. I'll introduce Shibu. Dinesh, please. Dinesh is walking right behind Nandan. He's one of the co-founders of the company, and he's the head of quality for all aspects of quality of the company. Shibu here, right here, he's also one of the co-founders of the company, and he's in charge of worldwide delivery. Of the 29,000 people, 28,000 report to him. Nandan will anchor the session. I request, please. Go ahead, Nandan. You have the mic. Question, David.
Yeah. Just to summarize, we have about half an hour. This is the last session before lunch, and I think you have heard a whole slew of presentations on different aspects of our business. We'll take questions, and based on the context of the question, I'll either answer it myself or my colleagues here or Bhaskar or Steve. Somebody will answer the question. Yes, let's start.
David Grossman with Thomas Weisel Partners. First question I have is maybe you could perhaps put the pricing environment into perspective. On one hand, we have your inputs, your costs going up, which we just heard 15%-17% on an annualized basis being wages, yet pricing is only going up roughly 1%-2%. Could you help us better understand why there's that disequilibrium between the cost of wages, which is really the alternative for your customer to go out and do it themselves, if you will, is going up 15%, yet your pricing is only going up 1%-2%?
Yeah. I think I'll ask Mohan to amplify, but I'll just put a point. You see, when we talk about 50% of our cost being people cost, the Indian rupee cost, the cost of people in India, is only about 10% or 11%. Therefore, the 17% increase is happening on that 10% or 11%. It's not happening on the 50%. It's actually the 17% of 11%. That's why it's comparable. Mohan, you want to add to that?
David, if you look at our cost structure, offshore salaries make up 11% of revenues. If it goes up 20%, that's about 2.2%. On-site salaries make up the rest. That normally goes up by about 3%. It also goes up only by 3% because there is a flow back of people, too. If you take the balance of about 40% and add 3% of that, that's 1.2%. Totally, we are 2.2 plus 1.2, that's 3.4%. The wage inflation in the model is about 3.4%. Out of 3.4%, up to maybe 1.5%, we get benefits of economies of scale, or the fact that we can really squeeze some expenditure because of efficiencies, et cetera. You have to get about a 2% increase in your revenues in terms of your pricing. The 2% increase in pricing could come about because of going up the value chain and change the composition of our revenues, could come about because of pricing issues, or could come about just because of the mix share. It could be more offshore, the mix could change, some things could go faster, et cetera. It looks very prohibiting from the outside, but in work of the numbers, it is not such a great impact as people think. Even within this wage pressure, we have managed to neutralize one of the three components of wage pressure. That's the entry level. At the entry level, there's not much of wage pressure at all. You may have to just give increases for inflation. Essentially, mid-level. At the top level, there's a lot of us floating around, so it's only a question of negotiation. Apart from that, I think it's understandable.
Top management doesn't work for money anyway.
Just another question, I guess, a presentation during the course of the day talked about the assumption of employee, and that's relatively new, I believe, for Infosys, particularly in the applications maintenance side, is assuming company employees part of an outsourcing agreement. Can you help us understand whether that's a trend that's going to increase?
I'll ask Chris to take that.
Also, Chris, if you can speak to what the economic impact on your model.
Okay. First is, we have a point of view on modular global sourcing, where we are reducing the need to repatch. If the client requires the full benefit to come accrue from offshoring, then you need to relook at what is the number of people who need to be repatched, whether it's every employee or not. and then can that be addressed upfront? Now, having said that, so we reduce the requirement to the number of employees to be. But having said that, we have over the years now created the capability to absorb more and more employees. You know, we acquired 330 people through expert acquisition in Australia. We have now a much diverse workforce across the company. We have enabled our HR organization and legal legal department to add acquired employees, and the requirement for global employees is growing. So one is minimize the number of people to be rebadged, and second is we are able to absorb now the rebadged employees. Today at 28,000 employees, adding 1,000 people, and we have a significant number of people outside India, adding 6,000 people outside India, so adding another 1,000 here and there, it is easy to absorb that. 330 people we have taken in Australia, just one geography, we are able to absorb that.
Just one last question, I guess, for Mohan. It sounds like I think 2 months ago when you reported the June quarter, you were at $21 million, I think, in incremental investments. That number, I think, is now up in the $32 million.
No.
Is that?
No. If you go back, I think the $21 million is the incremental investment we announced in July. But if you go back, the investment in consulting was announced in April. The $20 million investment in consulting was announced in April. And the acquisition was done in December of last year. So what was announced in July was $21 million, out of which $5 million went to the banking group and $16 million went to the business units. And in April, we had announced earlier $5 million for the banking. So really, we talked about the accumulated investments over the last several months, and 21 is just the incremental investment announced in July.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. Moshe Katri with SG Cowen. I have a three-part question. First of all, maybe just follow up on David's question, looking at CapEx requirements for the business. If one tracks CapEx requirements starting from FY03, 04, and 05, and so one of the metrics we focus on is the ratio of CapEx to revenues. The ratio has been increasing, 3%, 7.5%. I think this year it's probably going to exceed 10%. Should we read anything into that? Are we focusing on businesses that are a bit more capital intensive than the other one? And then
let me answer the question first. We typically need about $10,000 to $11,000 per person. And if you look at the CapEx expenditure in the past, it has gone up. It came down. If you go back 1 year before the 3% or 5%, it was 10%. It came down that year because things slowed down. Normally, we have to incur capital expenditure for the next year too. Let's say that we need to add 10,000 seats in a year. It takes some time and a while to do that. So we have to have something ready for the next year because every quarter you could be hiring 2,500 people. Right now, we had 25,000 seats and 28,000 people. And this quarter, we're going to hire a few people. So overall, we are running behind, so we need to accelerate. And the CapEx per person has not gone up. CapEx per person has not gone up. We require about 200 square foot of space per person. It costs us about $45 per square foot, on an average. We are right now running at about 160 square foot per person. The balance is required for training, which will catch up. And if you take that, that will be about $9,000. $2,000 per technology per seat. So that's about $11,000. And the technology needs are going up, so you could add another $1,000 depending upon the base. So each seat requires X amount of investment, plus for the earlier seats, you require at least $1,000, $2,000 per head per year for technology investment.
So basically, is there a way to isolate, if you're looking at these numbers, I think your expectations for FY05 for CapEx to be between 140 to 175. Which component of that is actually the hires that you're talking about?
Which components for the new hires?
Yeah.
Well, this year we could add between 12 to 15,000 seats.
So basically, it really has nothing to do with the types of deals that you're pursuing.
No. I mean, for us, CapEx means CapEx in the network, in technology, in PCs, in software, and in space. It does not mean CapEx in terms of capitalization of internal software. We write off all internal software. It does not mean capitalization of anything we do for the client, because typically we avoid that.
Okay. because that's really helpful. And then finally, you've highlighted all the cross-selling opportunities that you have into your existing client base. Can you highlight recent successes in these areas, maybe one or two or three deals, and how far are we in this ongoing effort?
Thank you. I'll ask Basup to answer, give a couple of examples, and then I'll ask Steve also to give, without naming customers, but where they have actually been able to get some traction on.
If you look at Infosys Consulting, it's still fairly early. Its focus has been on building out the team. But if you were to look at the pipeline comprises, equally but perhaps a little more weighted towards existing Infosys clients. So the pipeline for Infosys Consulting is more weighted towards existing Infosys clients, both from just number of deals as well as, probability to close, obviously, since they're existing clients. So we really don't see a whole lot of problem around cross-selling Infosys Consulting to existing
clients. Right. A couple of examples, not consulting, but other cross-selling we can talk about.
So if you outside of Infosys Consulting, if you look at enterprise solutions, we're selling that in enterprise solutions or our infrastructure system integration practice. We're very focused on selling them into, we just did a fairly significant deal with a banking client of ours, which is a large outsourcing client, where we sold something from our infrastructure system integration, which was a significantly higher, price points and the things we expect from cross-selling, which is to be able to sell more profitable services to existing clients.
Just a few examples. So we've had different models of cross-selling. We had one client where one of our managing directors had an existing relationship with a large retailer. Went in and they had not tried anything using the global delivery model and actually ended up saying, well, this makes a lot of sense. We'll try it with you guys. And so I think bringing in new clients and helping cross-sell existing technologies, services, that was a good example. There's another client, it's a large shipping company, where there was an existing stream of work for many, many years that was mostly around application maintenance and some application development. What we were able to do is to come in and to help them put together what they're calling a transformation management office. They're going to spend over $100 million over the next 5 years in changing the company. And basically they've hired us to figure out the best way to spend that to improve their competitiveness. And so there's examples where we've brought people in and had an existing relationship. Another entertainment company where we had a relationship and came in and helped bring a new client. So it's working very, very well in the field. And the thing is we're completely dependent upon one another for delivery for those type of projects. So the integration of the field is going very well.
Yeah, I guess as a process thing, what we have done is we have identified key accounts, about 50 of them, and for each account we are preparing a 3-year strategic account plan, which looks at it in a 360-degree way. That it looks at how to upsell, how to cross-sell, how to rebrand ourselves in that organization, what are the kind of relationships we need to build, what are the potential opportunities for new services. So there's a structured process which we are deploying across the company. To make sure that we get the maximum bang from the share of wallet of our customers.
Yeah, hi, Joe Vaffi, Jeffries & Company. Mohan, on one of your slides earlier, you said that the policy was to earn a minimum of twice cost of capital and average capital and thrice on invested. As the cash position and retained earnings of the company continue to grow, do you think you can keep that going, or how do you keep that going other than just dividending out money?
Well, this is a return expectation that we have. Right now we have 46% on capital employed and 137% on invested capital. We intend to keep it going by making sure that the margins remain at a particular pace. There is a certain amount of growth
and the capital expenditure does not go out of whack. It is on a structured basis. And overall, if we find that there is more cash than required, we will look at how to deal with that. Last time we gave a one-time dividend to our shareholders because we found it to be much more efficient. We do have an acquisition program going forward, and we will attack that. But this return norms are very sacrosanct. We're not going to keep the cash idle in the bank. We'll make sure that it works for our investors.
And then maybe one follow-up for Chris on, we haven't heard a lot about Progeon here today. Maybe we could talk a little bit about some of the expectations for Progeon in terms of revenue contribution and margins looking out at the business 4 or 5 years from now.
Progeon is a very strategic piece of the Infosys offering. It completes the entire width of offering that you have. So if you go to a customer and tell them that you have a offering from consulting to BPO, they tend to look at you with greater credibility and their greater trust. So Progeon today has 17 customers, that 15 of whom are Infosys customers, two have come independently from Progeon. They have now become Infosys customers. So Progeon is also adding to the Infosys kitty. And we have two customers who are giving us more than $5 million of business, seven customers who are in transition, and all of them are in the transaction processing space. Some of them do have a call center piece, so about 15% of the revenues come from calls, and calls are linked to the transaction processing they do. For example, by this year, we'll have enough work for 1,000 people for mortgage processing. We do end-to-end mortgage processing, 401k plans. We do sales account, sales order processing, the entire chain for a very large technology company. We are doing F&A accounting for one of the best companies in the States. And we're doing many things which are core to them. The sales cycles are long, takes about 9 to 12 months. The transition is long, 6 to 9 months. And once they get into steady state, they become an annuity stream. The margins in this business at steady state would be 15 to 20% net. And if you integrate the BPO services with the service that Infosys has in terms of building a technology platform and then integrating the processing work on top of that, you can possibly increase the margin. And there's a cross-selling opportunity. We tried that in a couple of customers and it's working pretty well. Overall, it's a very strategic piece. It will grow faster than the rest of the business because it is small. Right now, it's about 2.5% of the business. It should grow more than that. But we'll make sure that the margins of the entire business is not impacted because of this. There's some structural issues about this piece because it has a different kind of people profile. These are normally graduates, 21, 22, fresh out of college. Their aspirations are different. So we deal with them in a separate company for this purpose.
Sure. Frank Knapp from Lone Pine Capital. I have two questions. First of all, related to an earlier question about rebadging people. When you were talking about SGS and bringing on some large deal experience, you also sort of mentioned, I almost didn't catch it, something about financial structures or looking at different ways of financing deals. And I wonder if you could elaborate on that. That means that you're going to be taking on greater financial component in outsourcing deals than you have in the past. And then I have an unrelated question.
Chris? Possibility there? Okay.
Go ahead,
yeah. Yeah. Right now, we are not looking at taking over assets, you know, capital assets, but we may have to fund some of the rebadging expenses and things like that up front, but that's the amount of funding we're looking at rather than any taking over any infrastructure assets and things like that. And because of that, the margin structure will be slightly different in the short term. But medium to long term, the margin should actually be the same as our rest of the business.
You mean for a specific deal?
For a specific deal.
And then in an unrelated question, I wonder if you could just comment a little bit about the motive behind, I mean, you're spending, by your own numbers, 220 basis points on a couple of different business initiatives this year. And if you could just comment on some of the motives, particularly behind the consulting. It's a pretty new direction for your company, and I'm wondering how much of it is in response to what your customers are asking from you versus how much is in response to competitors like Accenture or IBM beginning to encroach on your turf, or even domestic competitors like a Wipro or Cognizant who've been at least more vocal, if not necessarily more aggressive about building out their own finance.
Yeah, I think just to go back to a few of the ground issues. As we said, we think that the outsourcing opportunity, the whole move towards global rebalancing of the workforce, is a mega trend. I mean, and I think we have all bought into that. And given the Infosys brand and our position in the pole position of this whole game, I think the opportunity for us is there. And moreover, as we emphasize consistently today, we are trying to create a scalable platform to access that. So I think the ability for us to develop growth is there. The challenge, as all of you have also articulated, is how do we make sure that we grow and maintain our margins? How do we make sure margins are sustainable? And for that, clearly, it's not sufficient for us just to offer a set of service and capabilities. We need to be able to realign this or restate this in the metaphor of the client's business, in the way the client sees business benefits, in the way that the client sees operational efficiency and so forth. And that's something which we are not as good as we could be, whereas we are very good on the capabilities, on the skill side. So, therefore, we believe that with our foray into consulting, it gives us that ability with people like Steve, Paul, and his colleagues to really take the raw material of the capabilities and the strengths we have and repackage that and reposition that in terms of business benefit for customers, which we think will enable us to, A, differentiate ourselves as well as to be able to maintain our margins. So there's a strategic intent to why we are doing the consulting thing. Now, the consulting thing, as I said, is about $20 million totally, but I think it more took $3.6 million for the first year. The second dimension is the investment. We talked about $16 million into our IBUs. Now, what we're really saying here is that we have structured into multiple business units, and Ashok gave an example of the strategy for what he's doing in the financial services space. Now, these guys are not only looking at adding customers and adding business, but they're also trying to understand, is there a solution that this particular industry needs? Does a bank need a solution for intelligent exception management? Does an insurance company need a solution for HIPAA? Does a retailer need a solution for RFID? So these are all business solutions, and which are very targeted, which leverage some kind of technology. And we think that will help us to differentiate, and at some point we'll combine the consulting and the business solutions to deliver the value. That is an investment of $16 million across all the business units. And then we are finding traction on a banking side. We are finding that our banking product is gaining worldwide acceptance. We recently signed a deal with the State Bank of India, where it is the platform for all their global branches. So it's going to be implemented in 20-odd countries. So we're investing $10 million there. Then we have taken a view that China is a competitive as well as an opportunity for us. So we are investing in China, and $5 million out of that is going to China. So each of those investments is really part of this strategic intent of how do we, now that we have the basic growth engine in place, we have to make the investments to differentiate so that we can offer customers a unique solution or a selling proposition which enables us to be sustainable on the profit side. And that's really the essence of these investments.
Just to add some more points to that. See, as we grow larger and larger, our clients are also expecting us that the relationship with them will expand over time. And it's an imperative from our side also. We have to grow our existing relationships. That means that we need to have new services, new solutions, new things they can buy from Infosys, rather than just the traditional services, because you will hit some limit at some point on what the client can buy from you, because they would have maxed out the services from Infosys. So you need to have constant addition to your service portfolio, solution portfolio, new value addition which we can bring to the client. As the relationship size increases, there's an expectation from the client of higher level of management, program management, relationship management, etc. So you need to have people with the relevant skills. We need to have the relevant solutions. So that's another requirement for adding all these people, services, solutions, etc.
Yeah, hi, Arindam Chatterjee with Emerging Markets Management. Two questions, really unrelated. The first one is, the business is still very focused on the U.S. You've seen phenomenal growth over the last 10 years or so. But what, if anything, are you doing to build a business in emerging markets, in countries like Russia, Brazil, South Africa? You mentioned China briefly. Not only from an opportunity point of view, but also to see as threats. I mean, could there be another Infosys from one of these markets 10 years down the road? That's the first question. And the second question is more on the, you know, you're hearing a lot of issues coming up in terms of what I would call the protectionism against the services industry. And, you know, we've heard about a case in the UK where they're now requiring disclosure of where the work is being done. Are you doing anything to address this proactively?
Yeah, I think in terms of emerging markets, really, if you look at our global delivery model, we think we have a model where we can connect to any resource pool and take advantage of that. And so at this point, you know, if you look at all the countries you mentioned, we think that China is really the place where we need to keep the closest eye, both in terms of the potential as well as the potential threat from there. So that's why we're investing in China. We're hiring about 200 people there. We're looking at talking to our customers and seeing which of them actually want some of their services to be delivered from China and so forth. But apart from China, I think at this point it's really the main focus. Coming to the second point, I think, you know, clearly, you know, there is a rise of, you know, protectionist sentiments, and that has been accentuated or exacerbated by the political situation and the elections. And that is not a thing that can be wished away. I mean, it may have ebbs and, you know, peaks in terms of the decibel level, but it's a genuine issue which we need to be concerned about. And I think some of the responses could be visas getting more difficult, or you know, companies being offered incentives not to outsource and offshore, or some other kind of regulatory impetus. So I think that's a risk. But I think the important thing is that, you know, ultimately we are servicing the needs of some customers. I mean, this is not happening in some, you know, in isolation. And the reason why we are successful, the reason why we have 40% growth, is somebody out there is getting value from this. Some company out there is getting value from this. Some company out there is improving its productivity, is reducing its cost, is becoming more efficient, is improving its longevity, it's, you know, it's becoming financially stronger, it's creating more jobs. So, I mean, so there are sound economic reasons for why this is happening. It's not an aberration. And therefore, I think the economic reasons, especially, you know, in a free market situation like this where productivity is so important, I think will be very dominant. The other point is that our beneficiaries, and I think you have to distinguish that from the car thing, because, you know, go back and look at the 80s and NAFTA, and, you know, the whole, they put a cap on car volume from Japan and so forth. There, Japanese companies were selling cars to American consumers, right? And certainly the consumer was getting a benefit, but Japanese companies were a threat to U.S. automobile manufacturers. Here, we're not selling to consumers. We are helping American companies become more competitive. And therefore, we are not a threat to American companies, except, of course, the incumbents in our business, but I'm saying the broad swath of American companies. And we are actually their allies because we are helping them become more competitive. So I think if you look at the political dynamics, it's different from the car backlash.
Hi. Yeah, Ed Caso, Wachovia Securities. We haven't talked much today about Europe, and I was hoping to spend a few minutes on that. How big is it as a percent of revenue? Where are your strengths geographically? Are the service offerings different? Is there a slower acceptance rate? Is that acceptance rate accelerating? And I understand there's issues with language, so are you now populating your off-site centers?
Sure. I'll ask Shibu to take that. Shibu?
Hi. You see, if you look at our percentage from Europe business last quarter, it is about 22%. Over the last 2-3 years, in fact, Europe itself is a separate IBU for us. We felt that the requirements in Europe are quite different at this stage. It is not the vertical focus which we need to have in Europe. It is more about the language focus. It is more about the culture focus which we need to have in Europe. That has given us results over the last few quarters. I remember about maybe 3-4 years back, it was only about 8 or 9% of our business, and today it is about 22%. So we have grown the European business. Predominantly, I think the traction has been also, you know, continued to be in UK because of the language issues. While Belgium, right? Belgium. But while I think it's only about 50 or 60% of our Europe business, the remaining business comes from the mainland, the continent. There, our challenge continues to be the language and the culture. They are different countries, and they require different kind of handling in each of those countries. We have recruited local speaking people. In Germany, we have recruited German speaking people. and you know, we continue to penetrate. We are also doing one other thing. The solutions which we are creating for the US market, we are taking to the European market and customizing them. So all these strategies are working out.
Incidentally, in our Indian analyst meeting, we present on a Europe strategy, and that's on our website if you want to actually give the detailed presentation on our European strategy. Okay.
Thanks. Two-part question. First of all, looking at pricing, and this is more of a big-picture question. We went through a major repricing process probably, you know, since the beginning, early 2000, and then the repricing phase took about 2 to 3 years, and margins kind of bottomed maybe sometime in the middle of last year. What are you doing today when you're pricing your engagements to protect yourselves from such an impact on margins? Is there anything different that you're doing today? That's number one. Number two, what is your view about the elimination of the tax holiday? Obviously, we're far away from there, but any feedback that you have on that one?
I'll ask Bhaskar to talk about the pricing, and then Mohan can talk about the tax holiday.
Okay. First of all, we try and look at pricing as just an overall revenue productivity number, because sometimes the issues get clarified by if you look at it from a revenue productivity standpoint. Because we believe that in the coming quarters, revenue productivity can be largely driven by service mix rather than rate increases, if you know what I'm saying. So all the stuff that we're doing on going up the value chain and investing in new services and new businesses is really about changing that service mix, which is very skewed towards application development maintenance, which tends to be the one where the focus of rate negotiations is. Having said that, because it's a large part of our business, does come from application development maintenance, the rates there are very important. So the approach we're taking there is to first of all, you know, put some process and systems in place which will allow management oversight of rate negotiations of when they come up, how much do we, what kind of rate should we ask for, how do we negotiate the rates, and different ways of sharing value, which will, frankly, we feel will be in the benefit of the client, because the way the value is shared, and at the same time give us a higher rate. So these are a few things we're looking at from a rate standpoint, but really focus in the next few quarters is going to be on changing the service mix.
We have a tax benefit in 2009, as you all know. The tax benefit is specific to a particular location and is there for 10 years. For example, our heritage building in Bangalore, which started off in 1994, has its benefits ended last year. So on that, we'll pay tax to the Indian government this year. So increasingly, as you go along, the locations which started off earlier will start paying tax. And the year in which these locations will start paying tax is there in the annual report. It's been there for the last 5-6 years. So all the incremental work till 2009 would come from locations which are tax exempt. So only the existing work which are maxed out will be liable to tax. So we'll not see a big bump in the tax rate till 06, after that maybe 1 to 1.5% a year till 09. What happens after 09? Well, there are two things happening in this country, in India. The first is that the government has come out with a proposal to reduce the general corporate tax rate from 35% to 30%. There's a massive restructuring exercise being looked at. That's one straw in the wind. Two, a new scheme called the Special Economic Zone has been initiated. If you are located in a special economic zone, the first 5 years you don't pay tax, the next 5 years you pay maybe 50% of income in the balance, and another 5 years you pay 30% of income. Our new campus in Chennai, we got about 130 acres of land, we're building a very, very large facility, is in a special economic zone. So hopefully, if you start a new location, we should be going to a special economic zone which gives you tax benefits. So overall, the idea would be to keep the tax rate down for the foreseeable future. We pay full tax in all countries except India. And in India, as you go along, part of the income will be subject to tax. But overall, the tax rate should be at manageable levels as you go on.
Hi. Maybe Nandan or Vasa can answer this one. Just on looking at the client profile that you have, the biggest clients in the $30 to $50 million range spend per year, can you tell us, do you guys have a sense of how many of those are already using multiple lines of services from you guys? And by the same token, if I were to look at the clients that are in the $1 million range, 140 or so clients, how many of those are actually using multiple service lines, or are all those just kind of like one-hitters right now?
Vasa, do you want to?
Yeah, above $30 million, they'd be using 3 to 4 service lines, almost necessarily. It depends a lot on the tenure of the account, right? The duration for which we've had it as an account, and obviously the bigger ones have been with us longer, and that's given us enough time to build upon the success in one service line and spread out into the others and cross that.
And what about the smaller ones, the ones that are like in the 1 to 5 million range?
Well, in the 1 to 5 million dollar range, the way we look at those accounts, there are some of them who belong to the new account category, right? So they're new accounts, they have the overall spend capacity, and we need to prove ourselves and then cross-sell and also grow the same service offering. In those accounts, it's just a matter of time. We are very focused on spreading out into different service offerings. There is another set of accounts where, for one reason or another, that scalability is impossible. It's not going to scale above $5 million. And there, actually, the way we'll... And there are several reasons for that. It could be simply that they've decided to fragment it so much amongst the spend amongst so many service providers that nobody has enough on their plates, or it could be that it isn't working out, or it could be that we simply selected the qualified an account that should not have been qualified and they didn't have enough spend. In those cases, obviously, we're more focused on making it work, the account work, and instead of moving into other services.
Yeah, I think I'll take one more question and then we can all break for lunch. Okay, well, no more questions, so I'll request Sandeep to wrap up.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for coming by and sitting patiently through all of this. I have just a couple last announcements before you guys go. And Nivedita is back there. Nivedita, can you wave your hand? She's the lunch lady. She will not let you eat till you give her the feedback form. So, and I'm not joking. So that's request number one. And request number two is, the lunch is across the hall in the other room. It's a buffet-style lunch, free seating. There will be members of Infosys Management. Everybody who's presented here today will be at a table. And we also have, there's Ashok. So Ashok is here, Basa, Hema, Steve, Paul. Here is Ashok. Hey, Bala, can you raise your hand? We have Bala also with us. He's the VP of Finance and Company Secretary. He's also available, and all these gentlemen are here. So fill up the forms. Then comes the food. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.